Regular supplemental meeting are called to order. Supplemental meeting is recessed. We want to welcome our newly appointed trustees and recognize our outgoing trustees. So our new trustees, Rob Walters, Joe Colanetta, say hello, and David Kelly. Okay, and our outgoing trustees, Nick Merritt. Like to say something?
Perfect.
Great.
Good morning, everybody. This is a different vantage point. I'd say, Josh, you look much more handsome from this.
That's hard to do.
Yeah, I don't know if you're doing something different, but just, you know. I just wanted to say thank you to all of you. It's been, you know, fantastic 7 years. I think this team has really meshed well together. And I really, really hope that you all, the new reconstituted board, will sort of learn and engage and follow through on a lot of the things we talked about and what we've done over the years. You know, I've heard lots of criticisms, actually quite a bit, when we were down in Austin, but I didn't hear a whole lot of suggestions from anybody else. I just heard criticisms. And so I really hope that the new trustees engage and really learn what we've done, and for sure always willing to take on new ideas and new approaches. I am very, very wary with that new bill that I think the possibility of reintroducing politics back into the board. You know, I just think, for instance, of that lawsuit that we settled, and I couldn't conceive of the dynamic negotiations of actually going to City Council for approval when we were working through that, and that had a very significant impact on cash into the fund. But most of all, I want to say thank you. I think that the staff here is excellent. Kelly, I've worked with lots of people in a lot of different roles over 40 years in business, and you are the creme de la creme, as my mother used to use that phrase. Josh, Ryan, all of you as well. Melissa, I think you guys are excellent, but I really feel like this fund is very blessed to have someone like Kelly stewarding it the way that it has. And so I just want to say thank you. I've enjoyed getting to know all of you, and I wish you the best going forward. So.
Yep. I just want to say on a personal level, just as a police officer, I thought Nick's been the chair since 2022, and I think he's been the epitome of calm but strong leadership to this board. And it's very humbling as a police officer to have people and everybody on this board. You guys volunteer your time to help us out, and this was a huge problem. This when he stepped on this board, we were in a very bad place, and it's very humbling that you guys take your time and volunteered it. A lot of people wouldn't say, "I want to jump on this." This into this huge hole and try to help, you know, find my way out. And he did, and I've been nothing but impressed with your leadership. And we were very lucky to have you leading this board. And I can say that honestly from all police officers. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
From the fire side as well, Nick, you came to the fire station. You spent 24 hours. You rode out with us. You didn't have to do that. So you connected with the members on a level that was far beyond just serving as a trustee, but as a leader here, you utmost integrity. I saw you. You were an advocate for the first responders of Dallas, and we appreciate it. So, you're a role model for sure.
Thank you.
You still are.
And I would like to say that you know, the board decided when the new board came on that we wouldn't spend system money on plaques or trinkets. You all are, you know, professionals. You've got, you know, stuff to last your lifetime. So typically we're not giving, you know, things to trustees when they leave, but the staff wanted to get you something, Nick. So we use our own money, not system money, and we have a little gift for you. Because we know one of your favorite parts of the job.
I guess what this is. So, as my system name and my name and the dates that I was involved from September 17th to March 21st. And this is.
Thank you.
thank you very much. I'm very touched, very honored, very humbled, and I just wish all of you the best going forward. So, and if I can be a resource as a civilian in any way, shape, or form, I hope that you all will call on me. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nick.
Thanks, Nick.
And so Tina Hernandez-Patterson is on the board as a non-member trustee and mayoral appointee since 2017. She also served on the IAC. And if you want to say anything, Tina?
Well, I have so much to say, but I'll keep it short today. First of all, I'd like to thank my fellow trustees, because working with you has been fantastic. You all have contributed in a way that's been incredible. I mean, from now until, you know, Michael Private Equity or Schomer and Taglioni about that, we all come together and we've done a fantastic job. I also like the opportunity to welcome the new trustees. Hi, Rob, Mr. Colonetti, Mr. Kelly, and I'd like to say that I'm very confident in short order that you will see the merit of what we've done, what we continue to do, and what we have done, what we need to do going forward. I absolutely believe and confident that in short order you will fall and you will see what we've done. There's been a lot of misinformation out there, and I think this will be a great opportunity to see what we've done. That's all I will say about that. Now, as far as, again, I would like to also direct a lot of what I have to say to the investment staff, and particularly Kelly, Josh, Brenda, Ryan. It feels like in the last 2024, there's been a lot of criticism about the acumen and about the level of expertise of this team. And I have to say that I am just always flabbergasted of all the things you do. I mean, Kelly in particular, your level of understanding holistically on a granular level and all these aspects of every aspect of this pension, you bleed pension. You bleed the FBF pension, and I applaud you for that. And in the face of this criticism that you've had in the last year, I think it was abysmal. I think it's really shameful that I say it often, that I thought we were going to get a ticker parade at the end. I did not think that we'd be villainized the way we've been in the last 2024. And along with the chairman, I will say one thing that I've also learned, and I'm never too old to learn. The two of you have taught me the biggest lesson of my career, which is that when you are faced with a situation where the other side does not understand the issue, does not understand the problem, and therefore doesn't understand the solution, it is easy to criticize. It is easy to criticize but the two of you have told me that cooler minds prevail and that negativity on top of negativity is not conducive to solving the problem going forward. And that in the face of that, the quiet is not weakness, but professionalism and respect of the process. And that we have to continue to negotiate with the city. And in doing that, that is not helpful. And I am a stubborn student, and I have not always done that. But I have taken that with me, and it's really, really important. And I've been really honored to work along you too, particularly in this fashion. I will say that we all have our imprints in this pension fund. And I truly believe the next and the new trustees and existing trustees, what we've done, I'm so proud of what we've built. I'm so proud of, regardless of what anybody says. And I do believe that you can take what we've done so far and build upon it. So I am absolutely confident that we've created something Teflon-esque and that it will actually serve people who it should serve, which is the police and fire and first responders of Dallas, of the city of Dallas. They should have a future benefits that they can depend on. They work hard. They put their lives on the line. And that's why we're all here. And sometimes that's forgotten. So, again, I'm so grateful, and I have so much gratitude, which I feel like is just a dearth. No one's giving it. The scarcity of gratitude and appreciation and just saying thank you for all you do. So thank you. Thank you.
ticker tape parade, but the shape of the vase is a trophy. So,
thank you so much. Thank you.
All right, now we're going to have a moment of silence for all the officers and firefighters who passed away last month. Okay, I will move to the approval of minutes from the regular meeting on March 20th. Any discussion at all on the previous minutes? Then I need a motion to approve the minutes of the meeting for March 20th.
So move.
A second?
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
You opposed? You guys have it. We're going to go to item E1. The brief comments. Any public comment?
Yeah, good morning. My name is Jeff Patterson. I happen to be Tina's husband, but I'm here on behalf of the police, I'm president of the Dallas Firefighters Association, and I wanted to come and just for a moment reiterate my group of almost 1,600 firefighters for the city of Dallas and our support for Kelly, Josh, this board. We know the work that you've done. We know that the work that you're continuing, you will continue to do. We understand that you inherited, the best, I guess I'm trying to figure out the best politically correct way to say it. You inherited a difficult situation, and we appreciate what you've done. And as kind of what Tina said, I don't think you get the full credit. I think some of the misinformation in the media is unfortunate, but I wanted you to know that Kelly, Josh, Ryan, staff, and the trustees, we appreciate you. We know that you do this, trustees specifically, for free. There's a lot of miscommunication out there. They think you're paid, but this is a total volunteer. You do it because you want to make this program and this fund better, and so once again, just wanted to reiterate that. Jaime Castro couldn't be here today. The president of the DPA had to go to a mandatory training, so I won't speak for him. But on behalf of the almost 1,600 members of the Dallas Firefighter Association, and I feel confident the full department, we're here in support of you, Kelly, Josh, Ryan, and the current board, and we have your back, and we appreciate what you've done and what you guys all will continue to do for us going forward. Thank you.
Jeff? Have any other public comment? Is it star 5 on the phone?
No.
All right, we can move on to item D1, discussion and possible action for individuals for consideration for board chairman, vice chairman, and deputy vice chairman election.
So just as a way of background, the statute requires that the board elect officers in June of every odd number year. So you would normally be, and you'll be required again, you'll see this item again in June in a couple of months. But since we lost both the chair and the vice chair, it's up to the board what you do in the interim. If you want to elect a whole new slate, or if you, it's really up to you all on how you want to handle it. Where we go from here.
So I do it all.
Seems today we can continue with the status quo where I'd basically stay where I'm at right now and wait till June and kind of get more of a feel for where we want to go, or we can nominate people today. We can, anybody has ideas who they want. All those positions are all three of them. Do that today, or it's up to y'all.
For the benefit of the guys who are here for the first time, can someone tell us kind of what's the status quo, Mike? Just kind of how are things working currently?
So the way that the board, there's 11 trustees. We now have one vacancy, which is one of the non-member positions. And the officer positions are chairman, vice chairman, and deputy vice chairman.
So right now we have a deputy vice chairman. That's me.
Okay.
Our chairman and vice chairman were replaced by the mayor.
So if I understand it, as a police officer, you're not comfortable being deputized? Thank you.
I think we keep status quo until June.
And so, just so I understand, so that would mean we'd have a deputy vice chair and the other two roles would not be filled until June. Is that the thought?
That's my thought.
I think we need to have a chair. I mean, it would be helpful. So I think the status quo would be tag moved up to chairman. I don't know. Do we need a motion for that?
I think it would be good for the board. I mean, whether you want to say he's chairman or acting chairman in the because he moves up because of the vacancies, I think it would be good for the board to sort of have an acknowledgement of that. It would whatever you want his title to be until what's required under the statute in June, the election in June.
I was just saying, like interim chairman.
Yeah, that would work.
So. That sounds different than the status quo. I thought the status quo would be that Michael remained deputy chair and leave the other two open until people get to know each other better.
You could do that as well. You could just.
So the options are really open.
I move that Michael act as chair for this month and we readdress the election at the next board meeting once we have a chance to. You guys get a chance to see things a little bit better. I mean, it doesn't seem like it serves much of a purpose to do this today. We have new people on the board.
I think it's a great idea, but why don't we just leave it as it is? Because it sounds like it's working. And you know, we'll just revisit it in June, or if we think we have to do something sooner, we do it sooner. But I appreciate the indulgence to let us kind of know each other and get our sea legs a little bit. So I really appreciate that notion. So why don't we just leave it as it is?
Well, what's the issue with making him interim chairman for the next month or so?
Why don't we just take one action and be done with it when everybody's prepared to vote on a chairman, vice chairman, and deputy? So I prefer to get to know everybody a little bit better and then we make a decision and it's done and move on versus taking an interim, particularly given that things seem to be working.
Michael's de facto chair right now anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Is that the title, de facto chair?
I prefer deputy.
Yep. I mean, deputy vice chair, that's where I'm at.
Is that?
So do we need a motion?
We need a motion, yeah. Yes.
Well, I don't think, if no. That's what they're going to do, staying, if you all agree staying, with
no.
Yeah.
No motion. Just to revisit in June.
Yeah. Okay. Is that consensus?
I appreciate you guys recognizing the slow member of the team. So,
yeah,
that's appreciated.
So, just so you know, after June, we need to appoint committees. So, the way that our committee structure works is there's a mayoral appointee, say on the audit committee, that's the one I'm kind of most concerned about. There's a mayoral appointee on the audit committee and a member elected member on there. And then there's a person that's appointed by the chairperson. So we were holding off on, we need to hold off on appointing the committees until we have a chair who can select that third person. One of the items you'll see here in just a minute is the audit plan because we don't have a duly formed audit committee. We would like to get that audit committee in place before we have the final audit, but the timing should work. We'll keep you posted if we're worried about that.
Okay.
So you'll see committee appointments coming after the election.
So then, oh, I'm sorry, not the back. So by not recognizing Michael as chair, there will be responsibilities that cannot be filled because we do not have a chair to do these appointments. What else?
That's probably the audit committee is the next one, and I think the timing of when we'll have a draft audit will be okay.
Yeah.
And
everything
else will just assume he'll sign off on the minutes and everything.
Does your charter provide for the chair to appoint
committee members? Committee members, yes.
Yeah.
Next item.
Do you want to go to a non-member to
yes.
the agency?
So as you know, Nancy Rocha, she's a was a non-member trustee. The non-member trustees were Nancy, Marcus, and Tony, and their terms were up August 31st of this year anyway. So the board has approved an election schedule. We actually have a committee meeting tomorrow with the nominations committee. Our policy that the board adopted says that anytime we have a vacancy in any of the elected positions, if the vacancy is more than 9 months, we have to have a special election. If it's less than 9 months, we don't. So we will just leave the non-member trustee position vacant until the August election. Okay. Any questions?
All right. The audit plan.
Brenda, do you want to do an intro?
Yes. Thank you. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
This morning, I'd like to introduce you to Carolyn Lattice. She is the new partner at BDO on our account. And this morning, she is going to go over the audit plan for the 2024 audit that we are starting now. Carolyn?
Thanks, Brenda. I'm the new partner on the engagement, as Brenda said. I do come with experience, though, doing municipal audits, so it's a kind of similar process. So I will hopefully there won't be any transition. We have a very similar team. The senior manager is the same from last year. So the plan itself is very similar. If we could go to the next slide, please. Okay. Next.
You can use the page numbers down at the bottom to help you navigate if you want them to go two or three ahead.
Okay, so if we could go to the executive summary. So, thank you. Okay, so I'm going to just talk through the audit timeline, and then I'll also talk through the audit strategy, including like the risks that we're going to be addressing. We normally go through an in-depth meeting with the audit committee, but since there's not currently an audit committee, this is the presentation that we would normally go through with them. I'm going to go through it sort of in a high level. We can get into any details that you would like to go into. All of the information is in the presentation that you have a copy of there.
Carolyn, would you prefer we hold our questions until the end?
That's fine, yeah. Okay, so our timeline is going to be very similar to what we've done in the past. So what we normally do is kick everything off right around now. We do most of our testing in May and June. What you see is kind of going into July and August, a lot of the investments we confirm with all the investment managers. Some of those take a little longer than others to get through. Brenda and I have been discussing possible ways to kind of move the timing up so it's a little bit quicker of a process this year. So we're going to move some of the valuation work on some of the investments earlier so that we can kind of get things done a little bit sooner. But that will continue to update you as we go through the process. Okay, so just an overview of our process that we do as the auditors of the system is we come in and we do a risk assessment. We go through all of our experience that we have with the system over the last few years that we've been auditing. Look at areas where we've seen issues in the past or where we've seen areas that are a little more judgmental, such as evaluation work, and we spend more time there. We spend a good deal of time also looking at the actuarial work as well. So I'm going to kind of talk through some of those bigger areas. Okay, but first, as far as going through the responsibilities of both the auditor and then of your group, it's our responsibility to perform the audit and issue an opinion on the system. And the responsibilities of the board with respect to the audit would include making sure that we're aware of any fraud related to the system. Any areas that you believe are more susceptible to fraud. We have a series of inquiries that are also included in your presentation toward the end that we'll go through with the audit committee once it's fully convened. But they usually will respond to that to those inquiries for us. As far as independence, you know, we do a full independence review every year to make sure that we're still fully independent of the system. And then independence is always a two-way street as well. So if there's anything that you're aware of as far as, you know, whether or not BDO is independent of the system, if something comes to your attention, we would just ask for you to bring that to my attention. And then the terms of the audit, the engagement letter was signed a couple of months ago, so we're all set there. And you know, no big changes as far as the terms of the audit. Okay, so as I mentioned, like the first step that we do is go through a risk assessment. So we look at prior year results, we look at any inherent risk within the system. We also do a materiality assessment based on the total assets that are in the system, and we look at anything that falls above a certain threshold. We do a pretty in-depth audit procedures on them. You know, we also look at any kind of recent regulatory or accounting and auditing changes, which luckily for this year, there haven't really been any new accounting and auditing updates, so it's been a pretty quiet year for that. And then we also do some work like around your control environment. So we look at your service providers. They provide the SOC reports, which detail the internal controls at their various systems. So we do a thorough review on those, and then we do some walkthroughs and everything with Brenda and her team to see the controls that are in place at the system. Okay, so now to kind of get into some of the detail here, and I'll give you like an overview of what we do in each of these areas, and then, you know, feel free to, as we go through, and I think maybe as we go through each section here, if you have questions on the specifics, I can get into them. So for our plan scope, the first thing that we look at is fraud risk. So we're required as auditors to look at any risk that that could be an area that fraud could be perpetrated as a significant risk for an audit. So what we do there with regards to the systems audit is we look at management override of controls. Management override of controls is an area of any audit that's a presumed fraud risk because the risk there can't be overcome. So what we do in order to address that risk from an audit perspective is we perform testing over any journal entries or adjustments that are hitting any of the financial records. We have performed inquiries both with your management team, the audit committee, and then also with your third-party service providers as regarding whether or not any unusual adjustments have been made to any of the system's records throughout the year. And as I mentioned earlier, we also look at internal controls. So there we're doing our walkthroughs. We review all of your service providers to make sure there's not any any deficiencies in their reporting that would impact the system. You know, we have seen over the years that, you know, the SOC reports do have some deficiencies in them. So like your third-party provider may have a deficiency that they've reported. We want to make sure if there's something like that in like JP Morgan's report that it's being looked at and addressed by management appropriately. So that's what we do when we look at that. And then again, we also do work on any controls that are in place internally at the system, and we do walkthroughs there with Brenda and her team. And then the next big area is the actuarial valuation. So we work with Siegel to get their valuation report. We do testing on the underlying data, so the census that they're using to create their report. We also look at any of the actuarial factors and assumptions that they're using to make sure that they look appropriate based on what we've seen. And then we have an internal actuary at BDO that does a review of the report as well. So we kind of pull that all together, make sure that everything that's flowing into that actuarial valuation, into the footnotes and reporting is appropriate. And then another area that we spend a considerable amount of time is making sure that the operation of the plan is in compliance with the plan documents. So we do testing around eligibility, and that's eligibility with regards to folks being enrolled in the plan and then also getting distributions from the plan, so kind of the ins and the outs. And then for active participants, we also do a sample of those people, ensuring that they're eligible, and then testing contributions on their behalf to make sure that they're appropriate. And we do that on a sampling basis. And then we do the same thing with benefit payments. We draw a sample of benefit payments. We look at the eligibility. We look at the calculation itself and then the payment itself as well to make sure it's all in compliance with the plan document. And then the other big area that we spend a lot of time on is investments. So what we do there is we send confirmations both to your custodian and then also to the various fund managers to get comfortable with the valuation of the funds that that you're invested in as of the year end, and then also for the investment income that that takes place during the year. We also do some testing outside of the confirmations where we look at benchmarking against publicly available financial information to make sure that the ins and outs look appropriate and that the valuation, if it can be benchmarked against like a public fund, is appropriate as well. And that's an area that I think in the past, like some of that just takes some time. So we've been discussing with management how, this year we maybe start that valuation process a little bit earlier so that we don't have any delays in getting the actuaries the information that they need from us and making sure that everything moves along pretty quickly. Okay, then, the last few items are just like as far as like other information. We look at anything that's material. We look at securities lending. We look at related party transactions. We spend some time there just making sure that any transactions with related parties properly accounted for, disclosed, approved. That's an area that can be manipulated possibly, so we do spend a good amount of time there. As far as other matters go, the financial report that is issued for the system goes through an internal BDO expert that does a lot of governmental reporting, and he does reads on all of our reports just to make sure that everything looks appropriate. But as I said, not a lot of changes this year, so your report should look pretty similar to what it has in the past. Okay, so then these next few slides that you have here is basically what I just talked through. It kind of gives the detail of all the actual steps that we do for each of the areas. And I'm happy to talk through any one of them or all of them if you want to. I know that this, normally we would go through this in detail with the audit committee, but because they're not here, I'm happy to go into as little or as much detail as you'd like. So any questions on the audit procedures before I kind of wrap things up?
Really quickly, and again, new, so what is your duration before you time out? So it sounds like you're the new partner on the account, so I'm just curious how much time we have with you. Additionally, no offense, but when was the last time the contract was out for bid, and what was the change in the pricing on the new engagement schedule, which it sounds like was just signed up? And then do you use acceleration centers? And if so, what aspects do you use them for? How do you protect the data? And then if you use any AI, is that within a closed system so we can protect our data as well? And then on any liquid valuations, if you could tell me how you guys work through that. Sorry for all the
questions. I might need you to repeat some of those, but but yes. So we don't have a required rotation on the engagement, so there won't be a specific time period that I'll be working with you all. I came on because the former partner that was on last year left the firm. So hopefully I'll be able to stay on for the foreseeable future. And then as far as using outsourcing or anything, we don't do that for the system at all. So everything is internally done by BDO. We do have offshore resources, but we do not use them for.
Yep.
Yes. And then AI, we also do not use AI for any of the audit procedures that we do. Again, we have AI available, but it's more for our kind of consulting wing. But as far as our audit goes, we don't. Nothing of that touches it. And then remind me of other questions.
Okay. If I can step in and answer the contract.
Oh,
she's new to the account. We went out for an RFP in 2021,
okay.
And we've our agreement with BDO lasts through the audit of 2025, and then at that point, we'll go out for RFP again.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you, Brenda. Mm-hmm. And then how much did the engagement pricing move?
So year over year, it has gone up 3%, but when we re-engaged after the RFP, we were able to secure a significant decrease in the pricing.
Now with you. Thank you. Oh, and last question. On illiquids, do you use the midpoint for the valuation on the range? So when you have illiquid assets, how do we just take it as presented? Do we put a
Send confirmations to verify. And if it's like, say, you know, a cash account, a bank confirmation is all we need on that. If it's a money market, something more like that, then we do some valuation testing against, like, you know, we have a valuation group within BDO.
And illiquids within the portfolio, Carolyn, do you just take the manager's valuation assumption or do you run any testing?
We do testing on all the valuations, yes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Unless it's an immaterial account or something, then we don't. But, yeah, anything else. Any other questions?
Just within your actuarial valuations, what are the principal issues that you run into in auditing actuarial evaluations, and what are the tough judgments that you typically encounter?
What we normally run into is with the assumptions used. So the discount rate is often one that, and not with the system itself, but like just across the board, that's usually where we end up kind of getting into discussion with actuaries. What I've found though is that most actuaries, you know, they've fully supported the rate that they're using. Sometimes it'll be like our actuaries will disagree and there's a little back and forth, but I've never actually, in my career, I've seen one where we actually said it was incorrect, but generally if the rate can be supported, we don't. We can usually kind of get there. And looking at the systems report from last year, it looked like there wasn't any issue with that. But other than the discount rate and the, you know, rate of return being used, everything else is usually fairly straightforward. Any other questions? And then in your slide deck there, you'll see these are the inquiries that we will go through with the audit committee once we have someone there to talk with. But it's basically all related to whether there's fraud or any issues related to third parties, related parties, that kind of thing. And these are standard inquiries that we do each year.
Carolyn, one last thing, and I promise I'll be quiet.
No, you're fine.
So at this size, there's no specific internal audit function inside the system, or is there? And if so, how do you interact with that? And if not, what do you do to kind of cover for the fact that?
Mm-hmm. And I don't think that there's an internal audit function per se. Yeah, and what we do is so when we don't have internal audit to rely on, we do all of our own substantive testing, and we don't, In the systems audit, there's not any area where we're relying on controls to like reduce our substantive testing. Mm-hmm. So we just do a full substantive audit.
Thank you.
And our controls work is just under auditing standards. We are required to gain an understanding of control, how it works, and present you with any material weaknesses.
So if you see something, you make a control recommendation to management.
Exactly, and then if it's something that rises to the level of like a significant deficiency, we would communicate it to your group at the end of the audit.
Yep. Good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, this last slide here is just a little bit on BDO system of quality management. This is our internal quality management. Yep. And then that's all I have regarding the audit plan. So any other questions?
Thank you, Carolyn.
Hey, thank you.
All right, we're going to skip on down to item number 10. Skip on down to item number 11, the legislative update.
So we wanted to, normally what we try to do is if we've got outside guests, we try to take those items first. And we also know that Michael has a hard stop today. So we wanted to go ahead and take a legislative item, which is probably what most of the audience wants to hear anyway. So we've got Jeff, can you and Ben come up? So we are going to start this particular item in open session, but we can go into closed session if there's things that we need to talk about that that would be appropriate for. So I'd like to start by introducing Jeff Williams. Jeff is with Siegel, our actuarial firm. We hired Siegel in 2016 when we were going through all the financial changes, and they've been with us. Is Caitlin on the phone, Jeff?
Yeah, I believe so.
Okay, Caitlin is also on the phone. She works with Jeff on our account. And we also have Ben Meshes with us. Ben is with the law firm Haynes & Boone. If there's questions about the lawsuit that the plan filed against the city related to the 2.025. Okay, so what I wanted to start with is I have a presentation that I prepared actually for the new trustees, and I'm not going to go over it page by page, but I thought in going over it with the trustees, it might be a good refresher for all of the board to see where are we differing from the city's plan and SB 1527. And just from my perspective, where I think the differences are, and then since I'm not an actuary, that's why Jeff is here, because I might think something's a big deal, and maybe from his perspective, it's not, or something else is a bigger deal. And expand, provide information that I'm not able to. So I'll start with the first two pages are just background, which you're all familiar with. As you know, on page 86 here, the board has followed section 2.025 by adopting a plan. That plan was adopted in August, and that plan is what we believe is law, and a court has confirmed that that is the case. Since that time, the city adopted a plan, and Senator West has filed a bill, SB 1527. SB 1527 pretty closely mirrors the city's plan. So I might call it the city's plan, or I might call it SB 1527, but I'm talking about basically the same thing. That plan, SB 1527, has passed the Senate side of the legislature, and it's now currently over on the House side. This is the status of the plan. My direction from the board, I follow the board's direction, is to oppose SB 1527 and to continue to try to negotiate with the city. And that's what I will continue to do until I get a different direction from the board. So this slide just tries to convey the differences between SB 1527, which is the center column, and what the board adopted, which is the last column here, relative to Chiron recommendation. Chiron is the independent actuary that the Pension Review Board hired. So Chiron had three recommendations. Their most important recommendation had to do with paying contributions based on an actuarially determined contribution, an ADC. And by far, they thought that was most important given the funding status of the plan. And there's been a lot of talk about the phase-in period of the ADC. Chiron presented five options. We selected, recognizing the city had budget issues, we selected the second to last option, even though we would prefer full funding right away. The city selected the last option. So our plan has a three-year step up to the full ADC, and the city's plan has a five-year step up. Both of those are within the independent actuary's recommendation. Where the difference in my mind, the significant difference between the city's plan and our plan is the way that the ADC is implemented. It's not the 3 and the 5 years, even though there's a difference there. That's what you see here on what I have labeled here kind of 1B. Chiron had a methodology that they laid out, and the city's bill deviates from that methodology in 9 significant ways. Those 9 ways, in my opinion, transfer the risk from the city to the pension plan. And I'll talk about those nine ways on the next few slides. Both, Chiron had a recommendation to lower contribution rates. The board thought that was important, but it was the lowest priority and recognized the city has budget issues. We did not include that in the board's plan, and the city didn't include it either. Chiron recommended a COLA of some sort, something that kicks in earlier than the COLA that's in the statute. The city's plan does not include any COLA, any stipend, nothing, and our plan does include a modest COLA, as you're aware of. In addition, SB 1527 includes some additional, what they're calling governance, and that is where they're able to control basically the calculation of the AAC, primarily by being able to weigh in on or basically having to approve assumption changes, which drives the AAC calculation. Any questions so far? So I have a few slides coming up, and there's a lot of words on them, but I'm not going to, again, go over them all. Just the structure of the ADC, Chiron took it, and they separated it into three buckets, basically. There's the big bucket, which is the current unfunded liability. That's kind of what I have illustrated here in the blue bucket, or in the blue bar. And then you have the annual normal cost, which is the cost of 1 year of service for somebody who's working. And then you have future gains and losses. Primarily, the largest part of what the city's going to pay is already what is owed. It's the existing unfunded liability. So in the calculation that Chiron has, that makes up 88% of the city's calculation. Basically, the way that this, the city has implemented this is not that different from where we are. So I don't have a huge heartburn over this piece, the biggest piece. What they have in their bill is a piece I don't understand, so I would like to either get that changed or figure out what it's supposed to be doing. They take the fixed amount. Chiron was, or the city's supposed to pay a contribution on a fixed amount, basically a mortgage schedule over 30 years of the existing unfunded liability. It's a dollar amount that they're going to pay $126 every pay period. But for some reason, they've translated that into a percentage rate. I don't know what they're doing with the rate. I don't know if they're going to apply it to payroll or projected payroll. So that's my only concern on that big piece. My bigger concern comes in this green box, the normal cost. And again, that is basically a calculation that the actuary will do annually to say, what do I need to fund for 1 year of pension service for this employee and this employee and this employee? This is going to be about 12% once the phase-in is complete of the total that the city comes in. It's a very important part, but it's not the biggest part. This is where my biggest concerns are, frankly. So they deviate from this, from Chiron's recommendation in the following ways on the normal cost. First is the normal cost is supposed to be calculated every year. The actuary does a calculation. They come up with a normal cost amount, the employers will pay 13.5% of that, and the city will pay the rest. That amount is going to fluctuate depending on...
Wait, John. Can you pause for a second? I've lost the audio.
Yes.
Kelly, do we need this to ask you a question or two? Or
we're waiting because I think the people on the that are listening lost the audio, so we're just waiting on getting that back so people aren't missing out.
Are you enjoying retirement? Are you on
about that. So back to the normal cost. So
Kelly, can I just ask you,
yes.
Just make sure you got to kind of dumb this down for me a little bit. So the blue box is just, that's not prospective. That's just the existing deficit. And so all we're deciding is how do we pay that over 30 years? What I heard you say is we do it 126 and the city has a percentage and it sounds like we don't know if there's a gap there or not. We just don't understand that quite yet. Did I hear that correctly?
Right. We don't understand that quite yet. I mean, the city has a amortization schedule that they have in their plan, which matches what Chiron has.
Okay.
And as long as they're paying 126 of that, I think it matches what Chiron was doing. I mean, sorry, not 126. As long as they're paying the annual amount on that divided by the 26 pay periods, each pay period, I think it matches what Chiron has. The fact that they've converted into a rate, I don't know why they added
that. We just have a question mark on that issue.
We have a question mark on that in the conversations with the CFO. He didn't know, he didn't have an answer to that. So I don't know if it's a problem or not at this point.
Okay, that's helpful. And then the green box is just is future contributions.
The green box is for the service that people are earning today and this year for all the their future pension, 1 year pension service.
Okay, thank you.
So in that, it's, and Jeff can obviously do a much better job explaining that, but basically in that normal cost amount, the employees pay the first 13.5% of that, and whatever is left, the city will pay. Chiron intended that that normal cost amount would be calculated on an annual basis, and that's what that payment would be based on. The way that the city has implemented it is they've hard-coded Chiron's numbers for 30 years and carried that out. So there's no fluctuation in the normal cost. They took the Chiron working schedule and built that into the bill, which isn't going to reflect future things that would change the normal cost. So they built that into the statute.
So that's just a Chiron projection, and that might be more or less as we go year to year. Do I understand that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
So they built that in as basically a fixed amount. They did add a corridor in there, which is another item. I think that's my item four here. Chiron did not recommend a corridor. In the corridor, basically, it says, let's say the amount was 6.7% in the future. They would have a plus or minus 5%. But that plus or minus 5% doesn't just account for fluctuations in the normal cost. It also takes into consider future gains and losses. So that may or may not be a wide enough corridor. And Chiron did not think corridors were a good idea. So that's my item four on here. The item three on here, well, let me talk about number two. In addition to the normal cost, as I said, there's these corridors. Those corridors don't start until year six. So really what has happened is the city has continued their fixed rate payments or their statutory rates for another 5 years. There's no fluctuation at all. So, you know, they're really not going to an ADC. They're continuing a fixed rate contribution plan for another 5 years, which is absolutely not what was recommended. And it's actually specifically warned against doing that in the Chiron report. The other thing that is most concerning to me, which I thought we might have solved in my conversations with the CFO, but he's backtracked on that now, is they talk about paying normal costs on projected payroll. And projected payroll might be okay if it is the actuary does an actuary evaluation this year and they project what next year's payroll is going to be and they use that number for that 1 year, that one projection. But that's not what they're doing here. And what they said this is basically they're going to take Chiron's payroll for the next 30 years that they projected now and they're going to pay normal costs on that. And you can already see why that is a huge underfunding of the plan, because just let's think about Prop U. They're going to add 900 new police officers, right? Or even 10 new police officers. They are not going to fund the retirement of those people at all with that schedule because they're not in that. So the annual pension amount for those new police officers or any raises that are outside of that will not be included in the funding that is outlined. I think that's a big deal. So those are normal costs. And Jeff can explain a lot better than I can. I'll turn it over to him in a second. The last item here in the green, in the red box, is the amortization of future gains and losses. All plans have gains and losses, not just from investments, but because of more people died than expected, or raises were higher than expected, or inflation was different. I mean, it's just a natural part of a pension. The city's bill doesn't allow amortization of any gains and losses for the first 5 years. So what's going to happen is, maybe they'll all offset each other for the first 5 years and it won't be a big deal. But if they all go one way or the other, you're going to have this huge snowball coming along in year six. But then you have to amortize that. And now you're subject to that upper corridor limit, and that's going to push that amortization out 20 to 30 years. And then you're going to breach it the next year, and it's going to push it out 20 years. You're going to breach it again. So this is just one big method to kick the can down the road. It's going to be a potential of what happens here with all of these triggers combined together.
And then what happens if you hit that five-year period, if it's above, okay, and what's their suggestion on how that is then amortized over what period of time for that amount that goes beyond the ceiling?
So they're taking that extra amount and they're going to amortize that over 20 to 30 years, basically minimum of 20 years. But it could be longer before 2033 just because that's just how the math is going to end up working. But basically, you're going to kick that extra amount that you owe for this gains and losses layer out another 20 years.
And then what happens on the inverse in the eventuality that it's below the floor within that corridor? What do they do with it then?
Below the floor, I can't remember if those layers get collapsed or it's also amortized. It might be, my guess is it's going to offset other layers, other gains and loss layers. I don't know. That would be a good problem to have.
Yeah, no, it would be.
Yeah.
Okay.
So those are really the structural pieces. Again, I'm most concerned about this. They really aren't even going to be paying the current costs that people are earning in their pension each year that, with this structure. The last piece is just some other items. The most concerning to me is that the city has to approve any actuarial assumptions that increase the liability. City council members are not fiduciaries to the plan, and they have competing needs. So that just has the potential of either underfunding the plan, but also giving a false sense of security on the actual funding level of the plan if the assumptions aren't really reflecting what we think is best plan. So those are the big issues. I also have information on the COLA here. I think we're all familiar with the COLA. Chiron recommended it. They actually sent a letter to the Senate to further explain their recommendations, and they didn't back off on the COLA. They said we still believe that, you know, a COLA is important. They didn't recommend a specific version of a COLA, but they reemphasized their need for a COLA. Just to remind you, the COLA that is in place here is capped out at 1.5%, and it takes funding level of plan times CPI. And in the city's plan, by the way, if this COLA comes in place, and even if this COLA weren't to come into play, well, it's not in their plan, so forgetting that COLA. But in the city's plan, any future COLA, say in 2046 when they're projected to come in, if all the criteria are met, the city will have to approve those. So they have veto power over future COLAs.
Kelly, just to clarify, I'm trying to keep up. You keep referring to a city's bill, city's
I know.
But it's really a Senate bill, 43.
But it mirrors the city's plan.
Oh, it doesn't mirror?
Yes, it's almost exactly. They basically tried to codify their plan.
So did the city propose a plan?
The city adopted a plan in September.
Yes.
So that's a city bill.
So the city, it's Senator West's bill, but it's matches the city's plan that was adopted in September.
Before Senator West conceived this idea for the Senate bill, did the city have a plan that presented to us, or was it presented to the city council?
The city had a plan, and we negotiated. We tried to negotiate with the city for basically over a year,
and
we tried to come together. The city talked about their plan in multiple meetings of their pension committee, as well as the city council. We talked about our plan. Our board adopted our plan in August, and the city adopted their plan September, I think it might have been September.
So they adopted it through city council vote?
Yes.
Okay, that's fine.
Yes.
Kelly, when they converted the installment payment on the annualized amount into a rate, did we ask why they did that?
I did.
And what did they say?
They don't know how it's being used.
I would have thought they would have applied it to the payroll dollars as the payroll increase so that you allocated it for individual member. But
I can't tell by reading the bill what it's being used for, so I did ask the question. Again, we were trying to negotiate with the city, so I had a meeting with the city manager and the CFO, and the associations were there, and we talked about kind of different issues. The city manager, I said I have these 9 deviations from the Chiron methodology that are my most concerning part of the difference. And she asked that the CFO and I get together and talk about those 9 issues. So we did. We had a conversation, and then we had, and we kind of, I explained what they were. He wrote them up. I tweaked his write-up a little bit, and we sent that to their actuary. And then we had a conversation with Siegel and their actuary and the CFO and I. And I asked the question in that meeting, why is this being converted to a rate? How is it being used? And they said they didn't know. And I said, okay, can we take it out? And the answer was, we'll see.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it's being used for. But I've learned enough from Josh and from prior legislative sessions that things in law and in the statute have a meaning, right? So I don't want to just ignore it and not know what it means.
Sure. Sure. I mean, you can see what it could be used for. I'm kind of surprised. And then the other issue is, to make sure I understand, because the second derivative is clear, if this is the case, it's an exercise in what the mandatory amount will be, but it is not necessarily the funded amount. So once this is settled upon, this will control what the mandatory amount that must be paid will be. But you can pay more than that if you want to, but
right.
You have to pay at least that.
Correct.
And so then the discussion becomes, what am I obligated to pay, rain or shine, hell or high water? And I could pay more.
Correct.
And then the fundamental issue is, if you fall behind, how do you catch up? Because if you're not paying the normal cost, and if you're not actually reducing the unfunded liability, and if you actually don't get a running start at the performance corridor, you either have 5 years of phenomenal gain or you have 5 years of horrible losses that you then have to catch up.
Right. Got so it. In 17, when the HB 3158 was passed, we knew it wasn't enough money, and all of our actuarial valuations show, you know, Jeff is calculating the ADC every year, and the city was putting in the amount of money they were putting in, and every year there's a gap. So it was obvious that the funding level of the plan was planned to go down and was going down because they weren't paying the ADC. But they needed time to ramp up to pay the ADC, which is why we've got the phase-in. The phase-in was only supposed to apply to the fixed amount, the existing UAL. It wasn't supposed to apply to the normal cost. So having a fixed amount for the normal cost for five more years and not recognizing gains and loss layers isn't consistent with that. Jeff, did you want to fix anything I said or expand on any of your concerns? Or
Sure. I mean, I kind of reiterate a lot of what you said because I've got a lot of concerns with, as you know. So just, I guess, one of them to make sure it's I'll clear with what you said. So we had a call, like you mentioned, with Ireland and their actuaries. And at that point, he said that they were going to contribute based on actual pay.
Right.
And you said now he's going back to saying they're going to do it based on projected pay.
Yes, I got an email last night that said, well, it says the two areas we're looking at, remember I gave them nine, the two areas we're looking at and considering if it's appropriate or necessary to edit are, one, clarifications that contributions are calculated based on actual pay, not projection. So that sounds like it's backtracked. And two, clarification about the city's contributions. So they're considering whether it is appropriate or necessary to make any movement on my nine issues. This is how I'm understanding that email.
Okay, well, hard. All right. Hard coding numbers for 30 years is a horrible idea, my opinion, my personal opinion. Saying you're going to pay this based on projected pay from 2023, projected 30 years, it probably has, what, 2.25% increase each year, I believe. Payroll is going to change. Like Kelly mentioned, that doesn't account for new hires. It doesn't account for raises over and above what's currently projected. It's just not good. It's not good. It's going to fall very short over time. I don't see how it wouldn't. Hard coding unfunded liability amounts, saying these are what the unfunded is going to be each year based on this component, that's not going to hold up either. Assumptions change over time. Assumptions will change.
No, before that, what's not going to hold up over time?
The unfunded liability amounts, it's not going to be the exact amount each year. It just won't.
Thank you.
Assumptions change over time. We're scheduled to a five-year experience study this year. We haven't even started on that yet, but assumptions change periodically. They have to. I mean, you set assumptions. You can't set assumptions once, and expect them to hold up for the next 30, 40 years. They will change, whether it's investment return, whether it's payroll growth, whether it's retirement. You know, patterns change. The personnel changes. The needs change. You know, folks are retiring at different ages or different service amounts than expected. They may turnover may be less or greater than expected. Disability. There's a lot of moving pieces in an actuarial evaluation. And saying that assumptions are never going to change is frankly ridiculous, and that's what it does by hard coding these unfunded liability amounts and by saying we're going to use projected payroll and not actual payroll. So those are concerns I have. Those are a couple of the concerns. Let's make some notes. The having saying the city council has approval over the assumptions, that's a huge, huge issue for any actuary. I cannot mandate your assumptions. I cannot set your assumptions. I recommend your assumptions. So an experience study, we'll provide like an array of assumptions. Like we'll do our work. We look at each assumption. It's okay. We think this is a good set of assumptions recommended to the board. Well, if the city, and I'm not casting aspersions, I'm saying there's a lot of risk involved with this bill, in my opinion. One of the risks is if city directs Deloitte or whoever may be their expert in the future to use a certain set of assumptions that are vastly different than ours, well, then the actuarially determined contribution amounts are going to be significantly different. And they already say in here, well, if they're different, they're going to have a 30-day period, and if you can't reconcile, then we're just going to pay the difference, split the difference. It's just artificially keeping the contribution lower, in my opinion. If we were using assumptions where we say, okay, listen, you have to use this set of assumptions, and we disagree with that, there's going to be caveats all over this valuation report that basically say, hey, here's your liability, here's your ADEC, we disagree with it for this reason. And we don't like doing that. I've never had to do that. I've been doing this over 27 years. I've never had to provide a caveat that says we disagree with the assumption you use in this report, but here it is anyway. I don't want to do that. Nobody wants to do that. So there's risk there. Like I talked about, the assumption changes, the stating what the administrative expenses are going to be for the next 30 years. I mean, we use an assumption, but again, you're saying the assumption is never going to change. What's appropriate now is the administrative expense assumption. That's a small component of it. That's just an example. What's appropriate now isn't going to be appropriate 10 years from now, probably. Costs will go up, cost of services, things can change. It could go down, but I'm just saying you can't set that in statute for 30 years. It's just, in my opinion, a bad idea.
Well, it's not going to fix the problem. It's not going to fix
the issue that we have. Ultimately, in the corridor, having a corridor, a maximum and minimum contribution, part of the reason we're in this situation is the city's never paid the actual determined contribution. They've always paid a statutory rate. Now, that's not the only reason we're where we are now. I'm saying that doesn't help. You can't say, okay, we're paying, 34.5%? Before that, it was whatever.
27.5%.
But actuaries typically do not like statutory contribution rates because this ultimately happens. They're good when they're set, but over time, they're going to, more than likely, the plan's going to outpace them, and they're not going to do their job. I mean, this is another way of saying we're going to make a statutory contribution, essentially. We're ignoring the ADC. We're putting all these caveats in here. We're making a normal cost payment based on payroll projected from 2023 at 2.25% each year, ignoring hires, ignoring payroll increases over and above, raises over and above what's projected. We're going to put a collar around the contribution where we're not going to pay any more than this amount. We're not going to allow for any assumption changes that will ever increase liability. But when we do an experience study, we hope liability doesn't go up, but we can't guarantee that. I mean, I don't work backwards from an answer and then find assumptions to meet that, because that's a disservice to the system. That does no good if we're not being honest and truthful with what we think is going to happen. Yeah, we keep in mind, obviously, there's budgetary considerations at play here. It's outside of my purview, but we're not ignorant of that fact, but we also are proposing a set of assumptions that we think will lead to really better funding of the system if the ADEC is being paid. The assumptions are set in order to, we look at what's happened in the past, we look at what we expect to happen in the future, come with a set of assumptions. And if the ADEC is paid on that going forward, then we should, at the end of the day, be fine. But, when we took over, we started in 2016, and we won't revisit all the history. A lot's happened. A lot was happening at that time. But about a year or so after we started, system was projected insolvent. All right, that's not new news. It was projected insolvent with the cash outflow at the time and everything that was going on. That's no longer the case, but you're still funded in the 30% range. This is not the time to cut back on making the contributions that are necessary just to be a viable pension system for the current and future fire employees of the city of Dallas. I can't say for certain this bill was enacted that all hell's going to break loose, but I'm just saying that there's a lot of risk involved here that is unnecessary in my opinion.
Jeff, in your experience, do most government plans have statutory contributions?
The ones that do usually are in more trouble often than not. We most of the systems I work with do not. The ones I've worked with that do have always ended up having to change that, pay the ADEC, because their fund percentage kept going down once the system outpaces and reality outpaces the statutory contribution rate.
67% of the public pensions in the state of Texas are on ADC. We're one of the allies.
Do we know the numbers nationally? Just out of curiosity.
I could try to find that out.
I'm
not sure.
Not on a national basis.
On a national basis, do we happen to know the numbers?
No. Let us know, Texas.
Okay. Jeff, I have a question. I have a question for you. It seems like your underlying premise is that the gate's going to swing one way, and that the Chiron's assumptions were somehow necessarily or intrinsically not conservative. I understand the incremental increase in police force and why that would swing one. I get that. But it feels like, for every risk, there's opportunity. And it feels like if Chiron was doing its job and was sound and prudent and reasonable, then it should be symmetrical, whether there's opportunity or risk in the future by not making these adjustments. What am I missing?
Well, this isn't Chiron's work, first of all. This is the city.
No. I'm talking about, but they're taking the Chiron assumptions and they're hardwiring them, as I understand it. And they're not going to adjust the proposal is they wouldn't adjust them over time. If Chiron is doing his job and they're reasonable and sound, I get the addition of the officers because that wouldn't reflect in Chiron's assumption.
I'm not saying anything. Okay, it's not about whether they were doing their job. Things change. You can't a projection done today for the next 30 years is not going to hold up.
But they can change either way.
They can, but
and it should be symmetrical. Chiron was doing his job on the risk and the opportunity, save the one issue about the increase in the force. That's what I'm struggling with here. It seems to be there's sort of an implicit assumption or bias in the premise that it's going to be skewed to one direction versus the other as we all sit here and look through our crystal ball about what the future is going to look like.
I disagree a bit, but first of all, I guess, you're low 30% funded. How much risk do you want to take? That's my first response.
If we were 70%, this would be a more reasonable. So is that a big factor?
I don't think this is a reasonable plan regardless, but it'd be more palatable if you were 70% funded. When you're 30% funded, as an actuary, we're trying to manage risk. That's what we're doing. So anything where risk is there, we're going to point it out. We're going to try to point that out.
Sure.
I'm not saying that my crystal ball is broken. So I don't know what's going to happen in 30 years if this is implemented and this is followed. I can't say for certain. Hopefully it'll work for you and things will be great. And this is an ugly bill that ended up working out good. But, I don't want to take that risk with the plan system and the shape you guys are in.
So the one thing that I would say, Rob, to your question is I don't know if Chiron's report would have been the same if their intent was take these numbers, don't recalculate for 30 years, put these in as a fixed rate. I don't know if it would have been the same. They did not intend for it to happen this way. They specifically said, do not pay this based on a fixed rate. They assumed that the actuary would set a reasonable assumption. They assumed it would be recalculated every year. And if they were making, if they, I don't know what the plan would have looked like had they made other assumptions.
And that's very fair. I none of us would, right? It's sort of a counterfactual.
Right.
But one would think that if that Chiron should be playing it right down the middle of the fairway, regardless of how the adjustments are going to occur in the future in terms of their point of departure assumptions. That's really my only point. Although I do acknowledge that it did not account for an incremental increase in the size of the force, which is a real issue.
So any set of assumptions, whether it's Chiron, if we had done this work, the projections that we would still lobby hard against hard-coded projections for 30 years. It's not a matter of whether they're doing a good job or not. I'm not questioning their abilities. You don't, this is, when you do the actual do projections, you're assuming every assumption occurs exactly as expected. These aren't stochastic projections. You know, they're deterministic projections. You're assuming everything occurs exactly as expected. And the one thing I can guarantee you is nothing's going to occur exactly as expected.
I get there. We know with a moral certainty you will be wrong. My only point is a modest one, which is we don't know whether we're going to be wrong to the good or to the bad. If they were doing their jobs, it should be symmetrical in that risk, absent this one issue of increasing the size of force. That's all I'm trying to understand.
I mean, I don't, you know, if they're doing their job, I've got a personal qualm with that. I've got no problem with, I'm not saying I disagree with everything that was done by the city or Chiron, but I've got no doubt they were doing the job to their ability. What I'm saying is that projections are usually valid as long as it takes to present them. It's going to, I have to flip an answer, but I've said that before. You know, because you know what you know, we see what's happening in the market now. We have no idea what's happening. Are we going to hit the bogey this year? I don't know. I mean, it's right now. You know, we had a huge bounce back yesterday, but that doesn't mean we're still not back to where we're going to hear. I don't know what's going to happen, and I don't know. I understand what you're saying, but I don't necessarily agree with it. Because you can't hard code a projection for 30 years. Things are going to happen. Things change. Hopefully they change for the better. I mean, but as an actuary, we're trying to manage risk, and I see a lot of risk involved here. That's my point.
Yes, Rob, you and I haven't had a chance to talk, and I'm just listening and observing. You know, risk means more things can happen than will happen. And you only know risk with benefit of hindsight.
Sure.
So I'm not following what you're saying. You presume symmetry and being in some middle point you're doing your job. Can you help me?
I think, if you want certainty, there's no question you adjust as you go along. Okay? What I was hearing, though, is that there is that these projections skew in the sense that it's far more risk than there is that there's actually opportunity, that they're wrong about the assumptions in favor of the plan. And I was trying to understand that. As I see it, if Chiron is actually doing the very best it can, then the risk and the opportunity ought to be about equal. Of course, if you want certainty, you're going to make those adjustments along the way as you go. And that's what I was trying to get to the bottom of.
Isn't actuary's job to consider the risk and project out on that? I mean, that's kind of what they're supposed to be doing. I mean, there's always opportunity. We know that's kind of the point of the ADC.
That is the point of the ADC.
Yes. So the city trying to hard code to me ignores what an ADC is. And I'll just talk about the guardrails or the corridor, whatever they want to call it. It's a budgeting convenience, but on a finite timeline, it's a mathematical impossibility. Because you can't just say, well, we're only going to pay 5% up or 5% down, because you might have losses more than that. And on a finite timeline, it says 2055, we have to be 100% funded. And that's the dead end date. So it just, I mean, on infinite timeline, we can do that all day long. We can do corridors, and that's fine. That just, to me, it's a convenience, and it just speaks to a lack of mathematical understanding on the city's part. And so that's one part of this, but it's just, to me, they kind of ignore what ADC is.
You know, I'm on my second wife. And the one thing I learned about after the first wife is there's his side, her side, and the truth, right? And so I appreciate what you're saying. I also understand all of you guys are certified, so there's no way there's an actuary running around pulling assumptions out of the air and running around with their hair on fire, or not for long. And so what it comes down to is what you just said, Michael, which is 20-50-52, it's supposed to be funded. End of story, full stop. And if it's not funded and there's not enough money to pay, somebody, the citizens of the state of Texas, owe you guys your retirement, and somebody needs to pay. And so the reality is this system is supposed to be here as a down payment on that promise to make sure that promise is paid. End of story, full stop. And so my question is, if it's not fully funded by 2052, what happens? Who enforces it? What happens? Because at the end of the day, if it isn't fully funded, I don't care what the budget of the city is, somebody better come up with the money to pay the benefits that were promised. And so this is the down payment on that, and the down payment should be sound. But if it is not, and again, pardon my ignorance, does the state come in and make up the difference? Does the state compel someone to make the difference? Does the state put a surcharge on the taxes? What is the enforcement to make sure that the money is there if we fall behind, or heaven forbid, we're actuarially insolvent and someone needs to make those payments? So who comes in to make sure that if we can't sort this out, to make sure that the promise that the citizens of the city made to you gets honored? That's what I'm trying to, because I appreciate what you're saying. I appreciate what this guy is saying, but you don't have any money. He doesn't have any money. You can't make anybody do anything. He can't make anybody do anything. And there's a promise that needs to be kept. And so I'm trying to understand how that promise gets enforced.
David, the plan that we submitted guarantees funding at that date. There's no question, no issue. Why we submitted the plan that we did is why our plan differs from the plan of the city.
But you can't know that. With these assumptions, you believe it will, but things change. But if the rate of return drops below what the assumed rate of return is, it ain't going to get funded.
No, they have to fund more.
It'll flow into the gain and loss, which goes into the...
Yeah, that's what the ADC is. It goes up and down depending on our returns.
It's going to flex.
Your question is the very reason why we submitted the plan that we submitted.
Yes. Because in 2017, we knew, because, look, we could talk about, well, what happens? Look, we've been telling them for 8 years we need to go to an ADC.
Okay.
They didn't do it. Now we're like, hey, let's go to ADC. They're like, well, let's put it out 5 years. Mm-hmm. Then they want to control how the ADC, I mean, from my perspective, they're going to underfund it for the next 10 years, and we're going to be back in Austin saying, hey, because what's going to happen? Eventually, there's going to be a come-to-Jesus moment, and they're going to be like, hey, you need to pay $400 million in this year, and the city's going to say, we don't have it right now.
Right.
And then we're going to go to the state, and they're going to be complaining we don't have it. And we're at the state right now, and they're complaining we don't want to pay $240 million. We want to pay, we can't even get them to pay $184 million, which they were statutorily required to pay previously. That's reality.
They're not doing what the – so what happens? Who, is the state going to step in and make them? Or I'm trying to understand, because at the end of the day, it is a projection, but at the end of the day, it's a negotiation, it feels like, right? Because unless somebody can make somebody do something, it's going to be a negotiated settlement.
Yeah, ultimately.
But then, actually, what enforcement power does the legislature have?
They can withhold funding, I guess, from the city. State funding.
So, in other words, the state could fund the amount that the...
No, I don't think the state has any interest in funding it. I think the state has interest in making sure Dallas lives up to their end of
the... No, I apologize. I just don't know the answer.
No, my understanding... I mean, I don't think we ever want to get to that point, but I think there's an implicit understanding that this is law, there's a reason this law is in place, and you need to follow the law. And the city right now currently is ignoring their own charter,
mm-hmm.
and they're ignoring state law. Now, what the repercussions are, I don't know. I know for the charter, they've had a notice that they're going to be sued. And going with that, when they say we're hard-coding this, did they hard-code the fact that rookie officers and a rookie firefighter is going to make $82,000? Because that's what that lawsuit's going to say, basically. Guess
right.
Then we're going to have 4,000, so we're going to have 1,000 more officers making you know, what is it, $8 million more? That hasn't been hard-coded in there. I can tell you that right now. So that's the danger in just saying, okay, Chiron had this plan, these are the numbers, because we know it fluctuates. That's the entire point of an actual determined contribution, to have a third-party, unbiased guy say, this is the money that has to be paid in this year. And next year, if our investments do well, you're going to pay a little bit less. If they do poorly, you got to pay a little bit more. Mm-hmm. But in the end, we're paying an unfunded liability that they have not touched in 8 years. That's the whole point. And we know that what that's projected to be, we might do better than that. You know, we know what it's projected to be going forward. Hopefully, our investments perform better, and it's going to be a little bit lower, and you know, hopefully, you know, but the bottom line is salaries of officers and fire aren't going down. They're going up. And they're going to continue to go up as far as we need more of them. And we need more of them because the city of Dallas is getting bigger. So hard coding anything is ridiculous. And to me, it tells me they do not have an understanding. They either don't have an understanding of what ADC is, or they just don't want to do it. And you know, pick your poison on that one. They either don't understand it, or they do understand it and they don't care. And from past history, to me, it indicates they don't care. Just a sad reality.
Kelly, going back, it's concerning when you tell me the CFO cannot explain why or how they got a percentage, figure out the yearly percentage. Can I ask, who actually wrote the city's plan and the CFO is not aware of what's in it? I'm just curious. Did they hire a third-party consultant to write this plan?
So there's plan that the city adopted that Deloitte wrote. And then that plan got translated into legislation through legislative council down at the state. So how that, you know, that little language that says converted into a rate, I don't know if that was ledge council, if that was something they were told to do. I just don't know how it's going to be used.
I'm going to make sure. Do you know, are there differences between the city plan and the legislation beyond this one issue that you're talking about that we have a question mark over, or are they appear to be the same?
There might be something else in the city's plan related to governance that might not be in the bill, but I can't remember what it is. But generally, I think it's probably 98% similar.
So help me out, and I just want to understand. So the ADC calculation, what is the actuarial return assumption? So it changes year to year. So it might be 5% 1 year, 10% 3 year, 20% the next year. So at the end of this year, with all the volatility, the return assumption for the calculation is going to be
6.5% is what it is for all the years of calculation.
Right. Right. And that's my point. So in other words, at some point it moves around, but basically depending on what that rate is. And so I could be carrying a huge endowment if we're performing at, you know, 9% year upon year upon year upon year with a 6.5% assumption, correct?
Right, and then
okay.
The ADC calculation.
Okay, yeah, no. I just wanted to make sure that I hadn't lost my understanding.
Yes, just to, so 6.5% is the return assumption. That's what liabilities are, you know, we use for liabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And then the ADC component, the gain.
And in your assumption, a percentage point of return is worth how much against the funded ratio of 6-7%?
I'm sorry.
So if you move the return assumption from 6.5 to 7.5, how much does that, or you moved it from 6.5 to 5.5, what does that do to the funded ratio?
Oh, the funded ratio, in terms of liabilities, each quarter point is approximately 2.75% of liabilities.
Yep. So about
ballpark.
About eight.
For normal cost, it's about 5.75, 6.25%. So a change in the normal cost goes directly into the ADC. A change in liability gets amortized over the 30th period.
I got it.
So we, you know, when we determine the ADC each year, there's a gain loss component. Obviously, that portion gets amortized. So the ADC is the employer's portion of the normal cost plus the amortization payments on the unfunded liability, you know, projected forward to the payment date. But So the, so 6.5 is not going to, I mean, we're like, we're doing an experience study this year. We don't plan on recommending change there. That's one we're pretty common on in our experience study. But
I don't want to pick
it. So if you hit 9% each year for 5 years,
not on 50.
You're going to get gains at least on the investor side. And we also have to consider there's a demographic side, you know, the personnel, the members. You know, you could have an asset gain, but an overall plan loss on the year, depending on what happens on the demographic. Usually the asset gain or loss is the leading factor, whether there's a gain or loss. Not always, but usually if you have a gain on the asset side, you have an overall gain. If you have a loss, you have an overall loss. It's not guaranteed, but that's usually the dominant for each year's gain or loss.
Yeah, no, I get the math and I get the heuristic, but thank you.
So I can give you the numbers. Based on our last valuation, 1.2, the unfunded, the net pension liability at 6.5 would have been $3.8 billion. At 7.5, it would have been $3.2 billion. At 5.5, $4.5 billion.
You pulling that from the GASB?
Yeah.
Okay, now keep in mind that's using market value of assets. That's not actuarial value of assets.
Aren't they the same for this year?
Oh, well, they were for 23, not for 24.
Yeah, but it's close.
Yeah, true.
Relative, so.
So all we have to assume is a 50% rate of return. We're done. Let's get out of here.
Is that a guarantee?
If we're compounded at 9% per year for multiple years, we should be high five.
No doubt. Thank you.
So we have Ben here as a resource. We've talked about pending litigation before. It obviously is integrally tied in a lot of ways to the legislation, what happens if people pass or doesn't pass, like that. I did discuss briefly with the three new trustees the case, but you know, I'm happy for the board to go into closed session and we can talk about the case in a little more depth so you can kind of get his views and you all can ask questions of him if the board wants to do that.
Yeah. You want to close session?